Good morning. Another week from hell in the Middle East. Following the walkie-talkie and pager attacks of the week before, Lebanon came under attack.
Death toll at the moment is 45 people, and there are some people still trapped under the rubble.
From Morning Ireland on Monday, Karim Shahib.
Hezbollah did fire mid-range missiles for the first time in this conflict, almost reaching the northern city of Haifa. So Hezbollah have also said that they're in an open-ended battle. So there's seriously a scale-up in the number of attacks.
And how are people responding there? Are they leaving where they are from and moving to a safer place?
Lebanon already has well over 100,000 displaced people since the beginning of the conflict. But as strikes get deeper into the country, that might, you know, impact even more people. Our understanding is that there are people who will be leaving soon, but it's still early stages. You know, it was just this morning where the calls were made for residents to leave. The Lebanese people are worried. I think having witnessed what happened and the widespread destruction, the crippling of the infrastructure, the humanitarian crisis, you know, and the images of displaced people staying in camps and now, you know, flooding with water right now after the first few rainstorms. Of course, I think they're worried this is going to be a prolonged conflict. You know, the last war that happened here between Hezbollah and Israel was in 2006. It lasted 6 weeks. The airport was bombed and it was a difficult situation, but things sort of cleared up pretty quickly. The uncertainty and the possibility of what it could be is definitely making lives very difficult for the Lebanese people, no doubt about it.
Later that day from the News at 1, Rania Abu Zaid.
Roads, highways, thoroughfares from the south are absolutely clogged with panicked families as they flee north. A number of Lebanese received messages, either text messages or recorded voice messages from the IDF telling them to evacuate their homes, saying that, you know, if they're anywhere near, if they're in a building where there are Hezbollah weapons, leave your town until further notice. The Office of the Minister of Information in Beirut was among those who received the notifications. So a huge escalation today. There is panic, there is fear, there is uncertainty about what is going to happen, and there is grief over the so far 100 people killed and more than 400 who have been wounded in less than 24 hours.
Then, drive time.
For analysis, I'm joined by Professor of International Relations, Fawaz Gergez. What do you make of what's happening?
Well, I mean, I think we've been warning about all-out war for the past 12 months. I think this is it. This is really a tipping point. Lebanon now is really, Israel is trying to turn Lebanon into another Gaza. There are many civilians who are killed, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry, including children, medical workers, women. I mean, it's carnage. It's just carnage. I think what Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is doing, he's playing for time. He's running the clock on Biden. He's hoping that his best ally, Donald Trump, will recapture the White House in November and will give him a green light to do whatever he wants. So in fact, not only President Biden is fueling this particular war, he is really allowing Netanyahu to basically trigger a wider regional conflict, either directly or indirectly.
The next day, the BBC's Jeremy Bowen spoke to Claire about what the Americans can and should do.
Towards the end of a US administration, the president is always something of a lame duck. There could be a new face in the White House, or there could be, you know, even if someone is going for a second term. And because Joe Biden has had to step down in a very public and rather humiliating manner, I think he's even more of a lame duck. And it's become clear, and there have been reports out of Washington, that his people are saying, look, we've run out of time. We're not going to have the impact on the Middle East that we certainly were hoping might be possible a year ago when this war started and when Biden went over to Israel and he had a grand plan for trying to sort out the Middle East involving a rapprochement between Israel and Saudi Arabia and a Palestinian state. Well, none of that has happened.
Mm-hmm. And all of that must give succor to Benjamin Netanyahu to continue on the path that he's on, despite the pressure that he's under at home.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are plenty of voices raised in Israel who are saying that Netanyahu wants to prolong the war in Gaza and other wars because this keeps him in office. It keeps his government together. He's backed by ultra-nationalist forces who are absolutely against agreements with Israel's enemies. And also, you know, if he stopped being prime minister, the war ends and he's still prime minister, his trial on very serious charges of corruption would restart again. So it's almost become an article of faith here in Israel that that's actually what he's trying to do. And the Americans and the Brits and others in private say very similar things.
On Wednesday, Nabi Boulos, Middle East Bureau Chief for the LA Times, told Claire about the Israeli interception of a Hezbollah missile.
Hezbollah has long vowed that for any strike against Beirut, or more accurately, the Hezbollah-dominated neighborhoods of Beirut, right, that would be met with either an attack on an Israeli city like Haifa or one like Tel Aviv. So, I mean, of course, in the context of what's happening in the last few days, this is indeed an escalation. We're talking about a ballistic missile that was thrown, that was lobbed at Tel Aviv. So that is a big deal. However, with that being said, it is part of a continuum of escalation we've seen really increase in the last week.
Back home, the airwaves were hot and heavy all week. Much of the discussion was about the Dáil bike shed and then the shelter at the Department of Finance. On Wednesday's Liveline, Cullum spoke to Tom Considine. Tom is a steel fabricator.
If you were doing a spec on a job for 18 bikes outside a building, what would be the upper limit? What do you think the top price would be?
Well, the very top price for a high spec shelter, I would think, would be in the region of 50,000 or 60,000 for the shelter element installed. But like, I wouldn't like the message to go out there that all bicycle shelters will cost 50,000 or 60,000 or even 120,000 or 300,000. You can have a very nice 20-bike shelter installed in your car park for 8,000 plus VAT. We've been in Safety Store Systems. We've been manufacturing shelters now for 20 years. And it's really just a shelter element that we're concerned with, you know. And typically we would go into a customer and fit it on their existing hard surface, be that concrete or paving or tarmac. I note in the breakdown that they've said 44,000 for granite. I don't know the area involved. I'm sure it's expensive, and it would depend on what level of groundworks needs to be done before they put in the granite. So I wouldn't be an expert on the granite element of it.
And just to prove that all hospital projects don't go madly over budget.
We installed a very nice shelter, for instance, at the main entrance to James's Hospital. It's a fully enclosed shelter, tough and glass. At the time, it was storage for 50 bikes. The staff there use swipe access to get in and out. So it's fully enclosed, fully secure, very nice shelter. And that would have cost in the region of 80,000. So That's for very high end.
And that's everything, is it? Did you put in the swipe enabled electrics, or did they do that themselves?
The customer did that. St. James's did that themselves. But we supplied, manufactured, and installed the shelter for approximately 80,000.
Nothing angers the public more than examples like this of a wanton waste of public money.
Harry McGee from the Irish Times on the Dáil bike shed.
I actually used a bicycle shelter yesterday myself.
Did you?
When the rain was falling horizontally in Dublin, and I luxuriated in its surroundings. And it was well used yesterday. All 18 bicycle burns were used.
It's not luxurious though, is it? Or is it?
It's beautiful.
Well, you got wet when you went from it to the building.
I did, but I walked from it to the building and it soaked.
And between the bike shed and the shelter of the Department of Finance, it all put Harry in mind of another protective structure in another capital he once visited.
But if you go to the White House, for example, I was thinking, I was in the White House in March for the Shamrock ceremony, and it's a beautiful building, but the security hut at the front is kind of like a prefab, you know, so you don't have you don't have that kind of finish. So I just think that it's people spending other people's money and not having any regard for value for money. And we saw it with the security hut, but mostly we have seen it with the National Children's Hospital, which is a scandal.
And I'm not even going to start the hospital because I won't have time to finish it. For Éireann Ród Éireann this week, the timetables, they were a-changing. This from the Today programme, when Duncan Smith, Labour TD for Dublin Fingal, took the railway operator to task over the new times.
It's unfortunately been an absolute shambles since the first timetable change came in on the 26th of August, which again was impacted the Northern Commuter Line and the Dart Lines, and indeed the line in from Maynooth. What it's leading to is massive delays in frequency of service. There's large gaps in the timetable at peak time, for example, between 7:44 and 8:15 in the morning. That's leading to an increase of people arriving for either the earlier or the later train, and there's been no increase in capacity. Trains are waiting outside Connolly, and then direct services that used to go beyond Connolly station, they're having to get off at Connolly. Interchange isn't a bad thing, but it is a bad thing when you get off and there's no connecting Dart, or it's just pulled away and you're waiting another 10 or 15 minutes.
This was the response from Irish Rail's Barry Kenny to Duncan Smith and clear.
After the timetable change on the 26th of August, which ultimately was too ambitious, and we changed timings on that because the punctuality wasn't being achieved, we have seen an improvement in the past week as a result of that change. It isn't where we want to be yet, and we are continuing to monitor the day-to-day performance. We do have, I mean, the issue we had this morning isn't related to the timetable, but obviously coming on top of delays that people have experienced, we absolutely understand the frustration and apologise okay. for that. I mean, looking at yesterday evening as an example, you know, our punctuality leaving Connolly Station on the northern route was at 100%. So what we need to do is, and what we are doing is, monitoring these times very, very carefully to see, is there any other changes that need to be made? Because it is crucial that people can rely on the service that we provide.
One of the towns on the northern commuter line is, of course, Dundalk. And Dundalk businessman Paddy Malone spoke to Cullum on Liveline about the omission of much of his county from a recent Fáilte Ireland TV ad.
It's been neglected for years. With the birthplace, as somebody else has mentioned there, of Cúchulainn, St. Bridget, with King John's Castle. We have so much history in this region. The number of battles that have taken place between the Gaelic Irish and Ulster and the rest of the Normans in Leinster, and both Fáilte have neglected it for years.
Fáilte Ireland have got in touch with us, pointing out that this is just one television ad they're running that Louth has been left out of.
Exactly the same thing happened in 2015 when they launched the original Ireland's Ancient East, because I was running a conference on battlefield tourism the day after that was run, and it started with the slogan, starting in Drogheda and ending in Cork, which meant that the land of Cúchulainn, the land of St. Bridget, was completely cut out of Ireland's ancient east. Right. Now, they apologised and corrected it. But here we are again, 8 years later, looking for another apology.
One of the highlights, for all the wrong reasons, from Liveline during the week was Nadia. Nadia is from Afghanistan, and she spoke at some length to Cullum about the treatment of women in her country. And, listener, she is speaking here about singing.
It's not even in your own house if you're singing for your child or if you're trying to play with your kids, because in some families they have already lost their husband in the war, or they have already lost their brothers or any male person in their family. They don't have a male person in their family. The mother is everything. The mother is a father, a mother, a brother, a sister, everything for a child. So she might do some singing, she might do some storytelling or something to be like everything for a child, but then she can't do that because they have banned it. And then if she wants to go to buy something like a grocery, or just to go to the shop to bring something for the kids, or even thinking of going working, she's not allowed to do any of those things, which and I saw on the news the other day that 3 million children in Afghanistan are facing malnutrition. It's just, I think, because there is no work in there for most of the families that has no men to go and work.
I told you it was tough. And that interview, as all the interviews that I clip here on Playback, are all available to listen back to on the RTE radio player or wherever you get your podcasts. On Friday's Today programme, Brian O'Connell spoke to Inspector Tony Miniter about what Gardaí call the death knock.
Personally, I've had to do it 5 different times, and each one of them definitely leaves a scar on you. You're left changed after each and every time you do it. Now, in fairness to our job, it has come on leaps and bounds over the last number of years.
Can you remember the first time you had to do it, Tony, and what struck you about it afterwards? Or I'd imagine there are moments that you can never leave you, really.
One of the first times, it was breaking the news to a woman who had already lost a son because of a road traffic collision, and now her partner was killed. It's devastating. The best way I can describe it, it's a bit like reaching deep inside somebody's body and grabbing their heart and their soul, and you literally are ripping it out from them with one sentence. I'm sorry, but your son has been killed in a road traffic collision. When you say those words, there's the person each time just kind of looks at you in disbelief, knowing, no, that can't be true. Generally speaking, you have to say it a second time and may even have to say it a third time so that those words sink in. And then it's just, you destroy somebody. I do a lot of road safety presentations, and it's a word that I use quite a lot, is destruction. You destroy somebody's life.
And speaking of destroyed lives, with all the focus this week on Lebanon, Gaza has not gone away. Here's James Elder from UNICEF.
2 days ago, Claire, I saw so many children, more than a dozen children in 5 or 6 hours in Al-Aqsa Hospital.
who have very severe injuries and somehow have been kept alive by doctors, by medical staff. They've got very, very anxious parents over them. Some have had entire faces reconstructed, but the platinum that holds it together is dissolving. Some of them had amputations and they need to, there's no more prosthetic work here. They need to get those prosthetics. There's a psychological trauma here as well, Claire. When a child has had an amputation, particularly a little child, if I look at Karma, a little girl I sat with yesterday who's seven, they don't want anyone to look at it. They don't want to look at it. They don't want a doctor. They're just denying it. These children need the help that is just across the border. Pick a country, just there.
So near and yet so far. We'll have more after this much-needed break. Welcome back. There used to be an ad one time for a nightclub. The tagline was, "Love stories begin at Zhivago's." Well, the recounting of love stories began on the Brendan O'Connor show last weekend. First up, Elizabeth Strout, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Tell Me Everything, told Brendan everything about meeting her second husband.
I was doing an event in New York City and I was on stage with my editor and he asked a question from the audience and I couldn't even see him and because of, you know, the lights. And then at the very end, he showed up first in line. And he left, and I remember thinking that should have been my life. And then we contacted each other. We met each other three times, and he moved in, and we got married a year later. We only waited a year to get married because we didn't want to scare the kids.
Wow, so romantic and impulsive.
It was really an amazing story for us. Anyway, it was astonishing.
Yeah, a coup de foudre.
Yeah.
Is that what they'd call that? Yeah, yeah.
I don't know, yeah. But it was just like, we were like, whoa, okay.
Okay, and it's still going okay. I'm taking it.
Oh, yeah, 15 years.
You know the way sometimes these things that start kind of impulsively
Yeah. But, I know. No, it's just gotten, it's sort of like we must have known each other previously almost somehow. I don't know.
Amazing, so lucky.
It is. We're so lucky. So lucky.
And just when you thought you had all the romance possible on the Brendan O'Connor show, in comes Jane Seymour and John Zambetti.
I actually went to see a friend of mine, Rusty Anderson, who's the guitarist for Paul McCartney, and he was playing with his little band at a small club called Dreamland in Malibu. So I was watching Rusty, and I turned around to go to the gents, and there was Jane with two ladies. You know, my eyesight isn't what it used to be long distance. And I thought she was somebody who I knew because I've lived in Malibu for 30 plus years. So lots of people know my face and I know them, but I don't know their name. So just to be polite, I usually, hey, how are you doing? And I was about to give her a, hey, how are you doing? And I said, oh, it's Jane Seymour. When I went into the gents, I called my son who was on tour. I said, what's going on with Jane Seymour? He called her son. The both boys have a mutual friend.
Okay, so you were co-parenting without ever
knowing. We were.
And she actually almost adopted
I did.
Him. So phone calls were made. We'll get them together.
And they did, because Swayze was performing the same place the following week. I went there, met this man in the corner where the grandmother was, and he said, I think we're supposed to meet. And I went, yes, we are. And that's it. We've been together ever since. He got hold of me, I mean, and didn't leave. I mean, he came to the house the next day, and we were talking about life for about 5 hours. The following day, I sent my family coming over. 13 of them showed up. They basically told me in no uncertain terms that they really liked him, so don't screw this up. He goes and sends me a song by text. He writes me a song.
And in her own words, that did it. John Zambetti and Jane Seymour with Brendan at the weekend. Also at the weekend, Carlo's finest, Saoirse Ronan, was a guest on Sunday with Miriam. She's got 4 Oscar nominations to date, and her new movie, The Outrun, has been described as her best to date.
We're very hesitant to brand it as an addiction movie. It's a recovery movie. You know, there is probably a quarter of the film where we watch Rona at her absolute worst. But then the rest of it is about her trudging on. It's about her taking it day by day. At some points, it's harder than others. But for me, even as an audience member watching it, this movie ultimately is about those brief moments of joy and lightness that we all kind of live for. I think apart from the personal reasons that I wanted to delve into a topic like this, also from a performance perspective, it was allowing me to explore things that I had never been able to with a performance before. Because I was playing someone who was under the influence, it meant that their judgment so often was so clouded that I could make the performance as big, as small, as ridiculous, as funny, as heartbreaking, as beautiful, as ugly as I wanted it to be, because for a large section of the movie, I'm not in my right mind. So actually, I don't want this to sound insensitive, but it is kind of a gift as an actor to be given a role like that where you can kind of go anywhere with it.
Saoirse Ronan there on Sunday with Miriam. On Tuesday with Oliver, Liverpool's leading literary lady, Linda LaPlante. She talked about her days as a thespian and dreaming up the characters of Prime Suspect. She also remembered her sister Dale, whose death at just 6 years of age had a huge impact.
Only now in my great age do I understand grief. And Dale was the firstborn, and Dale was exceptionally beautiful. And my mother was pregnant with me when she went to get Dale from school. And it was near Christmas. Yeah. And a woman with a pushchair said, "Don't go round the corner, there's been a terrible accident." And Dale had been hit by a 10-ton truck. Her little body had been caught between the wheels. And she lived for about 2 weeks.
Oh, God.
And they allowed my mother to sit with her until she died. And so Dale featured in our home as this special child, age six, never grew old, portraits of her, pictures, photographs. And even as a child, I was dressed in her clothes.
Wow.
And I can remember saying to my mother, "Is that me or Dale?" And my mother would go, "Oh, it's you." When my mother died, she didn't want any of me, my brother or my sister's things with her in her grave. She only wanted Dale's.
Another great writer was celebrated several times on Radio 1 during the week. And Tuesday was deemed Sally Rooney Day internationally. In the writer's hometown of Castlebar, in the Castle Bookshop, David Brennan spoke to Morning Ireland.
That's fantastic. There's huge excitement in the town, and obviously there's huge excitement in the shop amongst our staff. We're so, so proud to have what I would argue the world's leading author from our from Castlebar. It's just fantastic. And there's huge excitement among staff and customers. My mother read the book, and she thought it was one of the best books she's ever read. Two or three of our staff have read an advanced copy of the book, and they think it's brilliant. The fact that the physical copy of the book will be there in front of the customer at 8 o'clock in the morning, I think that's more of a buzz, and it's more of a shopping or a consumer experience than reading it on a computer screen.
And Morning Ireland also spoke to some Sally Rooney fans outside Hodges Figgis in Dublin.
She's an amazing writer. I really admire people who can write description really beautifully. So I have a really good time reading her stuff. It's very vivid. But I also think she handles politics really interestingly. And I think, especially in her most recent book, Beautiful World, I loved how she uses these emails to kind of sneak in these almost, it almost feels like you're reading these nonfiction essays from Sally about how she views the world.
I guess I just really loved her previous books. And there's been a lot of hype around this book in particular. When I saw the announcement a couple months ago that a new book was coming out, I was like, yeah, she's one of the first people to get it.
Someone else with the book out at the moment is Hector O'Hookagon. He popped up on Brendan O'Connor's programme, ostensibly to speak about the five favourite pieces of music in his life. But as ever, he's a one-man river of words, and this time, Irish words.
Chuimel me on galúnach. To rub softly in between your hands is the verb to chuimel.
His book is called Irish Words You Should Know.
Chuimel me an lá agam a bhean céile. Chuimel, isn't it beautiful the way?
Yeah.
It's almost like when you have soap in your hand and you're just rubbing it gently between the hand.
Doesn't that sound absolutely gorgeous? I think I'll chuimel the lá of my bhean céile this evening. Now, doubtless you're familiar with the term 6 degrees of separation. Well, Ascoilge, there are 4 degrees of drunkenness.
Merry would be Mairach, merry. You know that feeling of the day after the wedding? The wedding is in the Falls Hotel in Ennistoim, and then you come out and you have a day off, and still the Saturday, and you go down for 2 pints the day after the wedding, and it's called Mairach. Then you go into Tipsy, which is Sugach.
Yeah.
And then you're getting into Ermeshke, which we all know, Brendan.
Yeah.
And then the one which is the beautiful image of a big framed Irish man travelling down the main street after being having pints, supping gallons of Guinness all day. There's no danger in the but he's swaying left to right. He's moving and he's on his way home. That is cuíochta, and that is ossified. Cuíochta. And that's a word my mother used to always use when we were downtown in Nav and maybe going in on a Saturday to get a bag of chips, and she goes, look at your man, he's ossified, ossified.
Yeah.
And the word in for ossified, oscaige, is cuíochta.
No, it doesn't sound as nice as chumeling a love, does it? Hector with Brendan at the weekend. On Tuesday, Ray Darcy met a Cora. That is not the number of people necessary for a meeting. It is a West African musical instrument, magically played by Sekou Keita.
It's an instrument that's made out of gold, like calabash. It's called calabash, but like gold. Half of it and the other half, we use antelope skin to tie it. And there's a long neck, wood, you know, yes, sticking out. And there's all those two handle woods that they have to hold. And there's a bridge in the middle that make the string parallel to each other.
Uh-huh.
And there's a cross as well with wood. So you play it with two thumb and two fingers only. And the strings are fishing line.
Fishing lines?
Simply fishing line.
I know you had an album called 22 Strings, so I'd imagine it's 22 strings.
Yeah, it's 22 strings.
But is there's a variation, is there?
There is variation. I also have like a double neck, which is, you know, 44 strings. So I can move from one tune to another tune easily, and then I can do other stuff for us, because it's not fully chromatic. Traditionally, just the tuning is done by mood.
So by which?
Mood. So like you tune, it's like one tuning only, so you can't do chromatic stuff quickly. But with this one, as you can see, you have pegs and then levers, so I can move from minor to major quickly.
It goes out of tune very quickly, does it, Sekou?
It does.
Yeah.
It does. But, you know, this one kind of seemed to be getting used to, you know, the Irish way, I guess.
Yeah.
Welcome back, and this just might be the most important part of the programme this morning. This is the BAM for the senses, a haven from all the craziness we've reported on earlier. Tony Bates is a psychologist. He's also a writer, and he's an occasional guest on the Brendan O'Connor programme. He recently completed a retreat.
It starts in the morning at 4:15. The Cistercians pray seven times a day, and the Benedictines four. It's historical reasons.
Lightweights, those Benedictines. Yeah,
yeah. Just not with it, you know. But anyway, the Cistercians start at 4:15 vigils, and then it goes to, there are seven offices where you gather and you sing the psalms, you recite scripture, and you're in the stalls, and that's very beautiful. And it's not too long, but it's frequent. So there's the day is punctuated with these bells that go, and then you head to the church and you take your place in the stall and you get your books and readings in order. And there's a whole, I suppose, art form to that, which I got very quickly into, and I could really enjoy it.
Tony Bates with Brendan. Indeed, there was a touch of the monastery about the place this week, because a couple of days after Tony Bates, Brother Richard popped in to Oliver.
It's amazing what simply sitting properly, opening the chest, you know, allowing the breath to fall as it should into the diaphragm, all of those kind of things can begin to create a sense of calm, a sense of stability.
And that's the starting point, isn't it? Just to be aware of your breath.
Just to begin with the breath.
Several times through the book you kind of say, sit in a comfortable chair. You start back straight, feet flat on the floor.
Yeah, to ground oneself a little bit and then to become aware of the breath. Because the one thing you're doing in the present moment is breathing. All of the wisdom traditions of the world, you know, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, they all begin with the breath.
And where you put your hands as well, because obviously the prayer position, which we know if we grew up in a Catholic faith,
yeah,
it just brings you to that sort of place, doesn't it, where you're in your head.
Again, posture can often, there are neurological benefits to postures in that if you're moving to a posture regularly, what you'll find is that the mind almost preempts the posture and begins to say, okay, we're getting into that chair again, we're beginning to sit in this way, therefore we're about to become calm. The basic prayer posture common to all of the religions of the two hands kind of joined together, that has been shown recently in neurological studies to actually lower blood pressure.
And if you can stop slouching, sit properly and take a breath, why not take a walk? Here's Lisa O'Regan on trees.
Trees are incredible because they have this like regulation of for ourselves. The air quality is better around trees because of the oxygen. And it is proven now that they enhance our cognitive function because the air is so pure in there and it lowers that cortisol and the stress. And there's this kind of thing that comes when you're around trees or any type of shrubbery or bushes. It's just a little bit quieter because that obviously blocks out the noises that are around us from like cars and people. It's kind of you go into a little almost like a cocoon.
And you're saying no headphones, just listen.
No, that silence, we're so afraid of it now. And it's so nice when you're outside to actually leave your headphones at home and give yourself a minute to think.
And just no agenda, be in the trees.
Lisa O'Regan, walking at the weekend with Brendan. And maybe you need a 500,000 little helpers to set you on your way to that quiet place. Listen to Irishman Paul and Ukrainian Anton on Mooney Goes Wild.
I was in one very experienced beekeeper and he has big room where a lot of beehives, and when you inside you smell that smell, you hear buzzing and also a tingling, kind of your hair start goes up and feeling's great.
Now this house has over 10 beehives in it and there's two beds. Under each bed, there is, let's say, 5 beehives. Now, you could average in a beehive up to 50,000 bees during the summer. It's a big, big energy under the bed. In total, in our bee house, there is probably 500,000 bees. The dark Irish honeybee, Apis mellifera mellifera. We've also put vents in the beds. It's very safe inside in this place. The bees are not just freely flying around the place or anything like that. No, under your bed there's holes and there's mesh stopping the bees. You're very close to the bees, but obviously enough the bees can't sting you or anything. It's huge energy inside there. The smell, the sound, the micro vibration. We were just in amazement, but felt so relaxed, and we slept down there as well.
Michelle Brown reporting there for Mooney Goes Wild from the Valencia bee beds. The Doc on One told the story of Georgia Lillis and her campaign to keep her horse therapy centre in North County Dublin open. Her mother was Celine Cawley. Celine was killed by her husband Eamon in 2008.
The following day, a Monday, Georgia went to school as normal.
I was in the middle of Christmas exams for school.
Mr. Lillis had come back from dropping their 16-year-old daughter Georgia to school and walking the dog.
I'd done my French exam or my art exam, I can't quite remember. And I tried to ring my mum to tell her it went well.
46-year-old Celine Cawley was found unconscious here by her husband Eamon Lillis on the patio of their home.
But little did I know she was already dead. So no one was going to answer that phone.
She still remembers bits of that day.
The day it happened, I remember looking at myself and thinking, how will it feel or where will I be when I've not had her as long as I had her.
The house and the area surrounding it on Windgate Road on the Hill of Howth remained sealed off for a second day today as Gardaí continue their forensic examination and searches here for evidential material.
You can't go to your house and get clean clothes. Like, you literally, I had to walk around with a hoodie. It says Lillis on the back of my back for ages. It was hilarious. That's my uniform. I had Lillis on the back of my hoodie.
From the Doc on One, that's Georgia Lillis. This past week is Irish Sign Language Week. And on Wednesday, Irina was live on RTE News Now with simultaneous Irish signing. One of the guests is Jessie Grimes, learning and participation artist in residence at the National Concert Hall. She was there to speak about upcoming productions. And then this.
We're taking apart Beethoven 5. They set me up with a challenge to start off with.
And given that we're speaking, the ISL community is listening, watching and listening to us this evening. I mean, the Beethoven story is very interesting and something that I think has unfortunately started to affect you.
Struck a chord. Yeah, I'm going deaf. I'm about 70% deaf in my right ear. Hearing aid wear, if anyone's watching on the video. Yeah, reading Beethoven's letters and reading the way he was losing his hearing is quite similar to what I was going through and I'm going through. It's very it's very personal to present this, and it's a really interesting challenge to present this story of kind of overcoming adversity that Beethoven, you know, the story of Beethoven in essence in writing music when you're completely deaf, because of course deaf people can love music as well, and that's really important to say.
Jessie Grimes there on Arena on Wednesday night. You'd need a cup of something after getting news like that. Maybe Francis Brennan has the answer, as he made tea for Oliver.
Very important.
Oh, right, yeah.
To warm the teapot. Okay?
To warm the teapot,
yeah.
Right.
So halfway through the boiling process, you have to warm the teapot.
It is on, isn't it?
All right?
Yes. Halfway through the boiling process?
Well, you see, it's half-boiled water, so you just put a dash out of that into the teapot.
I would always have waited and used the boiling water. Very good.
Yeah, no.
It's a brand new teapot. It doesn't have all the stains and tannins.
No, it's fine. I have two teabags in my hand. Very carefully listen to this now. People take the two tea bags and they pop them in together, right?
Yes,
yeah, but you don't
do
pop
that.
Them in together, because when you do that, you only get two sides to brew.
Okay.
Do you understand? So I always completely separate them and pop them in individually. And now you have four sides brewing, the two sides on each tea bag. Are you with me now?
I'm stressed out of my mind.
Yeah, a bit complicated, but anyway, it goes that way. So that means that you get a better brew.
Okay, right.
Now, of course, people make tea in their cup. I never do that personally.
Oh, no, that's very, very vulgar.
No. In a mug, you might get away with it if you're up Kilpatrick or somewhere, that you'd have sort of a need to do that.
You'd have your Stanley flask there.
The kettle has just boiled fully, I hear.
It has.
So will we proceed to that area?
You made...
Okay, yeah, I'm making the tea now, everybody.
There, Francis is going over there, and he is carefully separating the tea bags.
Francis Brennan making the tea with Oliver Callan. Now, with all the talk of children's hospitals and bike sheds and, latterly, the security hut, the political sphere has been positively spinning with chat. And there was an ad for the late debate in the middle of the Today programme.
The Late Debate, every Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday night from 10.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
And it's great to have the Late Debate back.
An advert, a plug from Clare. Surely the happiest man in the radio centre all week was Barry Lennon.
The Late Debate Chamber back open for business once again for the new Dáil season, and what a few weeks we might have in store.
We've taken it on board.
As I decisions. Said, the review is due in quarter four,
exactly.
And the government is nearly at the end of its term.
It could come to dust.
Tim, anyone listening to this now is going to see the review is not going to pass the budget.
I could, realistically, I'm not sure that she wants me to actually announce the budget.
One of the panellists, Waterford Independent TD Matt Shannon, was fairly sanguine about the whole affair.
If we just went back 8 years, Jimmy Sheehan, who built the BlackRock Clinic and who built the Galway Clinic, had offered government the opportunity that he would project manage the National Children's Hospital, and the department and all the other officials said, no, we don't need you. It was certainly telling when David Gunning said today that he couldn't see any certainty on timelines.
And there was much talk during the week and on the programme of accountability. Louise O'Reilly from Sinn Féin.
Accountability will ensure that the people who are at the head of government are driving this project, and they are ensuring that the taxpayer is getting good value for money. Nobody can claim that a cost overrun of 1.5 billion and 17 completion deadlines missed is a good way, or indeed a decent way, to manage taxpayers' money.
Matt Shanahan again.
We need to grow up here and stop faffing around on these things. The idea, for instance, as whatever the OPW man said about, and I saw something in the paper the other day about the bike shed, it's a sensitive fabric. This is nonsense. I could bring you in tomorrow 10 fabricators, and all of them will give you a price to put that shed in, and with all the sensitivity and with all the design, for under €30,000. And the problem that we're not getting, there's no value for money quotient obviously built in here, where we arrive at a point in time where somebody says, how much? €335,000. Yeah, go ahead and do it.
Matt Shannon there on The Late Debate with Barry Lennon. Now to the second of our playback advice slots. Here's Agnes Boucher-Hayes on some kitchen essentials for new students.
you know, having tuna, you know, that's a really good staple. You can add it to pasta, have it as a sandwich filling, have it with a baked potato. Both baked beans, and I would say black beans, chickpeas, butter beans. Butter beans can be lovely if you just cook, you take the butter beans out of the can, put them into a pot, add maybe a little bit of sweet chilli sauce, cook them and mash them down, and it's an alternative to potato. And you don't even have to peel a potato.
What a great idea.
Yeah, that it's actually really nice. Sweet corn is lovely as well. And of course, you can't go wrong with a couple of tins of tomatoes.
Gosh, the butter beans sound nice, don't they? All of those plates and pots and pans must not be left, dear student.
Just to remind people that when you go to college, you mightn't know the basics of cleaning.
First of all, clean as you go. Do not allow pots, pans, cups, saucers to reside in the sink with loads of water in them. Yes, you can steep a pot or whatever, but my suggestion is when you're buying a pot or a knife or the frying pan, get ones that you can clean easily, you know, that they've got a coating on them. But you've got to clean as you go inside in the kitchen. You have to sweep the floor. You have to wipe down surfaces. You know, you have to wash things. Not under a running tap. You know, it's better if you can use hot water and have soap to wash them in.
Write this one down too.
You know, when you're cleaning as well, remember you also have to clean your bedroom and your, you know, you might have a bathroom. And one of the rules of thumb that I would have is you'd use a pink cloth, pink for the sink and blue for the loo. So that's one way that those two colours, you know, they're for different rooms in the house for different parts of cleaning. So pink for the sink and blue for the loo.
The next piece of advice from Thursday's Drive Time was kind of included in the answer to a question.
Did anyone mention doing makeup or eating breakfast in the car?
No, not this time around, but no. I have witnessed that myself.
Have you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Which one? Sorry. Lots of people have.
Which one? Sorry, the breakfast or the makeup?
The makeup one, I think, for me. At traffic lights, you know, ladies guilty of putting on their last finishing touches before they head into the office. So, yeah, I've seen that once or twice.
But I mean, if you're at traffic lights...
Ah, now, come on.
No.
No, okay. I'll move on.
I think there may have been an implicit confession right there from Sarah. Best move on. We'll put Cormac in the corner this time. What goes in what bin? Again, Drive Time yesterday.
You buy a pizza of a Friday afternoon and you eat the pizza, but there's little bits of pizza still on the box. You scrunch it up, I take it, and whack it into as much as you can into the recycling bin. Correct or
absolutely
no?
Absolutely not. No. So if you
go on.
So if you get your takeaway on a Friday evening and you have your pizza, there's going to be oil and cheese obviously on the pizza box. But because it's cardboard and it's paper, that can be composted. So you can put that into your food waste bin.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tin foil. Shove it into the general bin. Correct?
No, not at all. Sometimes. It's a very interesting one because now, you know, we'll have Christmas in a couple of months and we'll all be using heaps of the tin foil. I know I do. So if the tin foil is clean, you can just scrunch it up and put it into the recycling bin. So let's say you're doing your Christmas dinner and you just have some tin foil over your bread rolls for your soup. That is clean enough to go into your recycling bin. However, the tinfoil you use to put over your turkey while it's cooking, that will have burnt oil on it.
Yeah.
It's probably not going to be able to be washed. So that needs to go into your general waste
bin. However, that gets me, I must say. It's difficult to follow, isn't it?
Dr. Joanne Rourke from My Waste, speaking to Cormac on Thursday's Drive Time. Tuesday's arena had live music from Lisa O'Neill. She framed one of her performances as a lament for her beloved record store in Cavan.
The music shop in Cavan is called Multisound and it opened in 1988 and it was always there, you know, as far as I remember.
Did you buy records, instruments there?
I bought my first tape in there, Alanis Morissette, Jagged Little Pill. All my musical education, well, and then you save up enough money and go in and get the record that's coming out, you know, it's all very exciting. I can't say enough about these little record shops and how important they are. And so many of them closing, but even that shop, Noel Tierney and Multisound in Cavan Town, very good to me when I put out my first couple of albums independently. You know, they put them on their shelves. This is important in young people's careers to have these stores and this kind of support at home because it begins at home. And, you know, sure, of course, it grew from there. And I was lucky enough to eventually be signed to a record label. But that man never took a penny off me. He didn't take everything that came in for those records he gave me. He insisted on giving me every penny back.
So he didn't sell them and make a profit.
No.
He sold them and gave you the money.
because he was invested in the local artists, and like he was with so many, with the Stripes and Áine Cahill and so many others. But it's sad to see them closing, you know. He's sad about it, everyone's sad about it, and it's just not feasible anymore. Mm. It's a sense of community, these record shops. They're important, and bookshops as well. So I've decided to sing Goodnight World, a nod to that record shop.
Which was on the last album, wasn't it?
And it's with that performance of Goodnight World, live from Arena, that we conclude this week's playback. Till next time, bye-bye, and thanks for listening. Here's Lisa O'Neill.
Settle your head, pet. Send your bones to sleep. Every moment that we rest brings a moment's peace. You'll not be missing nothing. The sunshine sleeping too. The stars are lining up low to watch your dreams with you. And if you make a wish on one before you go to sleep, you might meet that very star out there in them dreams. Good night, stars. Good night, sky. Good night, moon in sunshine. Everyone I love lies under you. Good night, trees. Good night, bees. Good night, rivers and valleys. Good night, big old bold world. Good night, world.